Hi, Ronald. Welcome back.
Hey, Adam. Long time.
Yeah, when was it, you know?
2020 or 2021, I think.
Yes, 5 years ago. It was July 2020. And the episode number was 95. So it was the beginning, getting good ideas from .NET.
Yeah, indeed. And it worked out.
Yeah, and back then it was easy to schedule a meeting with you. Now is an entire department of assistants trying to schedule a meeting with you. So you are like larger than Microsoft, feels like, from outside.
Oh, no. We are five people now in total.
Okay,
and,
cool.
And I do have an assistant, which because I really don't like emails and calendar management. I'm really mm-hmm. bad at it. Mm-hmm. And then I read this great book called Buy Back Your Time. Mm-hmm. And yeah, then I decided to hire Donata, who is helping me with everything related to following up that customers are paying and mm-hmm. doing my emails and calendar management. And it's nice. It helps a lot.
Yeah, good you said that, because my first impression was that the Donata was from a marketing agency, you know?
No.
Because what frequently happens is I get a lots of requests, actually a few requests per week, and the marketing people, or I don't know who it actually is, agencies try, you know, to push their guests to my podcast. And what happened frequently is that an old guest from back then now is indirectly promoted by a marketing agency, and they wanted to come back to my podcast. So what I do usually, I ignore the agency and I contact the guests to know what's going on. And yeah, so it's also crazy stuff about the podcast. It's still the same format, just
that's
fun.
Before, yeah.
But I don't know why, but I get a lots of requests. Lots of people would like to be there. And what I usually do is, okay, you can only be there that if you have something to do with Java or remotely with Java. And even I created on the podcast page beyond the podcast some criteria, because I just cannot, as you know, I cannot just spend all my time managing the podcast. This podcast is just hobby and fun for me.
Yeah.
But on the positive note, I took a look at the job runner, and you have almost 3,000 stars on GitHub.
Yes.
Which is remarkable for such highly specialized software. So it means it was actually a good idea to start that. And I also look at the code, and it is lean, beautiful, and fresh. And you have even, you know, CO2 our jobs, which is a great idea. So what happened in the last 5 years? So are you happy with the situation? So just give me an update. So we saw us at various conferences, I think at DevOx, right? And and so forth. Yeah. So what's the state?
Yeah, well, it's I'll quickly summarize the last 5 years perhaps in a couple of minutes. Mm-hmm. So what happened? We went on the podcast. I kept maintaining the open source version, and then I also created a pro version. With the idea that if a customer would buy the pro version, I could take out my wife for dinner once, because mm-hmm. I was allowed to work on it for 8 months almost full time without mm-hmm. Bringing home any income. Mm-hmm. So I created the pro version, and then it was calm. And then summer of 2021, I got my first real customer, which was mm-hmm. US based. And what they do is they do telephone programming, in fact. Mm-hmm. And often it's like all those Cisco telephones in companies. And why they like JobRunner is because it automatically retries if the job fails. And often these telephones are not always plugged in yet when they roll out their software, and mm-hmm. it was a good match. And then I was allowed to go speak at Spring.io with Sergi Elmar. Mm-hmm. And that was like really, then JobRunner suddenly started to take off, because it looked like it was a little bit supported by Spring. And now we have huge customers like Decathlon is a customer mm-hmm. of ours. and other banks and companies that all want to do a lot of batch processing. And then I noticed that we were doing about last year somewhere about 1 billion jobs a day, because mm-hmm. there is some anonymous usage data that we collect, which of course can be turned off. But I said, yeah, if we do that many jobs, then we have perhaps the opportunity to do something good for the environment. And I don't know. I think also in Germany, there's a lot of strange things happening with climate, like floodings or droughts. And so then I decided, okay, let's do carbon aware job processing, where we collect data from the energy grid. This is in Europe, it's called ENSOE, and they provide like a forecast from 34 hours when mm-hmm. there is like a lot of renewables or not a lot of renewables. And based on that data, we make sure that your job is then scheduled at the right moment without causing.
This is the best idea ever, because what I thought about, you know, the for instance, this LLMs training and AI, right? So what I thought is this should be actually completely carbon neutral,
yeah.
Because we have so much, excess solar energy. So it should be absolutely possible, you know, to train the model whenever sun shines, you know.
Yes.
And this is what I don't get, because this is like, you know, it should be possible. Of course, at the beginning is harder because it's the start and so forth, but. It should be possible, and your idea is really great, because what you could also do, right? You could make it even dependent on the energy prices, which usually correlate with CO2. This is actually the great thing, because CO2 is good for the environment, but if the CO2 is low, the energy prices are usually as low as well. So you can even save money for the companies. It's actually a good business idea, right?
Well, you got one point completely correct, because it was easier for us to use the energy prices than the actual carbon data. So yeah. We, in fact, behind the scenes, use the energy prices. And from our analysis, it's 99.9% of the time it matches the output of carbon.
Yeah, so absolutely.
That's
and you can only convince managers with money. But thankfully, sometimes it works, right? Because there is a direct correlation between energy consumption and price, and
yeah.
complete carbon. Different story, accessibility of web applications and usability as power user, the same story, right? If you say, yeah. I would like to build an accessible application, no one's interested. It's like, okay, let's build a great application for power user with, you know, shortcuts and right tab behavior, and everyone gets interested. But it is also good for accessibility, right?
Yeah, indeed, exactly. You formulated great.
I absolutely unprepared, as always on the podcast. But I took a look at the job runner API, and I think the job runner is almost dependency free, right? Or you are using lots of external dependencies?
No. We only have one for the moment, and we're currently looking to removing it. So we, back then, I learned a lot about bytecode, to be honest.
Okay.
Because what JobRunner does behind the scenes to capture the lambda is we need to do some bytecode analysis, the mm-hmm. same like Spring does and Hibernate does to find out what you're actually all doing with your POJOs that you want to save, for example. But we do also bytecode analysis to capture the details of the lambda that you're, mm-hmm. you want to schedule. And for that part, we use ESM. Mm-hmm. And except for that, SLF4j as an API for logging, but that's our only two dependencies. And now,
why Log4j? Because you could use Java Util Logging.
Yeah, in the end, it was a bad decision. We're still debating whether we should switch to Log4j or even Java Util Logging. But yeah, sometimes you make a decision without knowing all
Not even Java Util Logging. Java System Logger, you know?
Yeah.
There is the facet which uses behind the scenes Java Util Logging, this Joule, and this is what I use all the time. There is one downside: if you don't configure anything, you will get two lines for every log statement, which is bad. But you can, with one liner, you can configure this, so it's not a problem. And I used it as a facet. It was meant to be used inside JDK, but you can absolutely use it for business application.
Yeah, well, I'm learning something new again because I didn't know about it. I only knew Java logging, to be honest.
Java system, if you take a look at system and logger, this is a built-in facet in Java. And behind the scenes, it uses Java util logging. So it means, you know, the entire discussion in projects, we need a facet. We already have the facet, and we can use, you know, we can use Java util logging as default. If you're not happy, pick something different. But everyone was happy so far.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
The only downside I just noticed is that it's only available since Java 9.
Yeah. And your project is based on JDK 1.1? No.
No. 8. I'm afraid, but the world... And this, we support everything latest and greatest. We are already testing 25 and even 26 previews and make sure that we keep compatible. But the world is still, for a large part, running on Java 8.
Mm-hmm.
We have,
and you can change it easily nowadays. What I do with from time to time, I have the possibility to talk to managers in such a project, and what I tell them, Java 8 is not secure, which is half true. You know, Java 25 ships with thousands of bug fixes and whatever.
Yeah.
And this is what convinces them. You know, you should never argue, is it nicer? Who cares about nicer?
No, indeed.
Managers don't care usually in larger companies about developers, you know, convenience. But if you have numbers, and number can be, for instance, speed, memory, and security, because speed and memory means right now in the cloud is money. Exactly the same. So you can absolutely save money by migrating to Java 25.
Yeah, definitely. But sometimes, and this is also the case, we have certain medical companies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certifications. Yeah,
compliance. Certifications are then. So I learned so much these last years. I never wanted to learn much about. Mm-hmm. Even to be honest, we once created a bug. And people were not getting their cancer results anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it was a Friday night. I was in bed already because we have three young kids at 8:30. And suddenly I get a LinkedIn message from the States. Mm-hmm. Ronald, people are not getting their cancer results anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Luckily, the bug was already fixed in the meantime. So they were on 6.1 and the bug was fixed in 6.2. So mm-hmm. I asked them, can you please upgrade and check again and that fix it? But oh, that's the moment I got really scared, and I now have an insurance. If I ever make a mistake, the things that you learn when starting such a company, it's unbelievable.
But this is a great news that you can actually start a successful Java company. It's pure Java, right?
It's pure Java.
Mm-hmm.
It's pure. The reason is, well, I really love Java. It's a bit verbose if you compare it to other languages and stuff, but I...
Is it really? Because if you use, for instance, Java 21 and Java 25, so I had, for instance, so in a project, they had a Python reference code for LLM inference, and I had to migrate it to Java.
Mm-hmm.
So and look at the code, try to understand what's going on, and migrate it to Java 21, and it was shorter.
Interesting. Yeah.
So I don't know why in the Python the JSON was a lot of code. I forgot what they did. Only Java it was like multi-line string, right? So this was actually at the end for me, it was more readable. But the Python code was supposed to be like an easy. This was not like production code. It's like, you know, illustrate how to work with. So I would say if you are pragmatic with Java, you can write, you know, more terse codes or less characters, but I'm not sure whether it is more readable. But if you are pragmatic with Java and you leave off, you know, all the interfaces, patterns, just forget about that. No XML, no YAML. Just write Java code, Java records, classes, enums. It is beautiful. So for me, it is really hard to say what can be improved, right?
Yeah, definitely. And even once it's compiled, it's so fast these days. That's the one thing I also like. It's the benefit of the compiler, the type checking, everything you get around it. It's, true.
Maybe the last point about Java, because I wanted actually to discuss about JobRunner. Otherwise, we will meet at conferences again, and I will ask you, what has actually happened? And now we have the opportunity, to to promote it a bit. So what I did the last 5 years, maybe because since Corona, this was like after 2020, I think, I forgot when it was, but more or less all the projects were in the cloud. Mm-hmm. And this was caused by disaster recovery and various reasons. And so I moved basically from on-premise to the cloud. But if you go to the cloud, you get charged for the cloud, right? And with Java, the cool story is Java is crazy fast. And they are and Java is top five when it comes to speed. So and Python is 35 times slower than Java.
Yeah.
JavaScript, Ruby, everything is way slower than Java.
Yeah.
So if I showed the statistics to management, say, look, we can pick Python if you like, but you will have to pay for it. It died immediately. So there was actually not even a discussion. Okay, then don't do it. We didn't know about that. Then pick Java. I don't care. And by the way, Java was number five and number, it was like C, ADA,
ADA,
and something else. There was like Rust was faster. C, ADA, Rust, C++. Then Java and Go was already slower than Java, interestingly. And so you can save money by being faster. And now the question what I always get, what about memory? Because Java is more memory hungry than others. But the cool story is if you go AWS and Lambdas, what you are doing, you are buying with memory the CPU. So usually we have far more memory than we can actually use in our projects. So this is why I spend all the time with Java in the clouds, nothing else, just pure Java or Quarkus, because also fast.
Yeah.
You mentioned Spring Boot. The problem is it starts a little bit too slow and Quarkus is not faster. So this is not an option for me in serverless. But with Quarkus, Micronaut would be an option, or Helidon would be also an option, but Helidon has no support for Lambdas, for instance. This is another problem. But so we have this. And now with there's actually perfect storm on the horizon, because the economy right now is not doing that great, because the managers are thinking that developers are no more needed because LLMs are super smart and are able to generate code, which is perfect, which is not true, but they will find out soon that this is not the case. But this is like the meaning that we only need Vue developers and everything else is vibe coding, and and it's always the case, 2008, 2001, if there was a little bit of crisis, Java had a high time because there were no experiments and everyone said, okay, this worked, forget about esoteric languages. We just do whatever we know. So this is Java. Then, I don't know whether you're aware of Tornado VM. So what they do is this like GPU acceleration for Java, and they have breakthrough. Ooh. So what you can have is model inference with pure Java without external dependencies.
Ooh, wow.
And I already did some talks and screencasts. So you can run Llama on pure Java without anything. You just run it.
Cool.
And you get 10 tokens per second, but now they have breakthrough on NVIDIA. They have 6 to 10 times faster. So you get 100 tokens. And this is also interesting because large companies say, okay, we would like to maybe a local inference, not depending on the clouds. And with this you can do, and Java is really easy to install.
Yeah,
so if you have CI/CD pipeline, you say Java and you have it. So compare it with Python. I'm still not sure, what to do to have a Python environment.
Yeah.
And with Java, is a double click, or do you say, what DNF or whatever, I need Java, you get Java and you are basically done.
Yeah.
And there's a Project Babylon, and there's Simbis. Yeah. And so it means and Java gets so many interests. So I think I have in the next few weeks 11 conferences, and the other half I had to reject. So there are lots of interest in Java. But is this independent from Java 25? It's just a generic Java topic, which is a very good sign. And there's Project Leiden. There is Wasm support for Java. So I would say Java... And Java syntax became great, right? So, it is...
And stuff like that.
Yeah. So, this is what I say. It is good for you and good for me. I also like Java. And all the years I ignored all the, Java-related programming languages, I'm happy with the decision because I have more and more fun and less time, which is not that good because it's too much fun, right? So I need a boring project. So if you know a project with lots of XML and 20 layers, maybe I should join such a project for half a year, to have something boring to do, to edit 20 XML files, to have, one insert in a database. But right now, great times, right?
Yeah. It still exists, though. The 20.
I know it. And there are people and architects who believe in it still. You know, this is.
I cannot imagine. I cannot imagine.
Okay, now forget Java. Back to Job Runner. So, this is distributed, and you already said you have to analyze a code a bit, because if you think about, I could say, okay. Job Runner, who needs that? We have executor service. I mean, I'm happy and it works, and we get virtual threads. Even better, I do nothing, and I can start millions of job in theory on my machine. And if they do nothing, it will work. If they do something, it will break, but at least I could start them, right?
Yeah.
Another question is, why we need Job Runner, and why I should not use executor service? Or even better question to you, this you should answer. When is time to use executor service and not Job Runner?
Oh, I like it a bit that you reverse it. It's good. When should you use the executor service? Well, if you don't care about the state of your job, so let's say that your task that you pass along is not critical, and if it doesn't succeed, go with the executor service. And like you mentioned, even with virtual threads, there are limitations because objects still use memory sometimes, depending on what you're doing. Database calls that slurp in a complete table sometimes, I've also seen. So yeah, use executor service if it's something really small that doesn't matter when it fails or when your pod gets killed.
So it means the main feature of Job Runner is the persistence of the job.
Persistence of the job, retrying automatically, and the distributed processing.
And transactions then. So somehow it has to be transactional because the job is done or not done and nothing between, right? Consistency.
Yeah, indeed.
Okay, then the name is not good enough. It should be like, you know, how to call it, Batch Runner or something. Batch Runner, but Batch Runner is old school, you know? Job Runner is cool, but Batch, no one will be like, okay, we don't need Batch. So the name does not indicate the full power.
True. And also, the same thing. You can use executor service to, if you use the scheduled executor service, to schedule tasks next week. Mm-hmm. But if you deploy between now and next week, your task that you scheduled is lost. and also that. So the whole scheduling recurring tasks and all of this, that's where we shine. So indeed, perhaps the name was not chosen correctly, but I liked it because it was really short.
Yeah.
We do jobs, and that's,
You should do what SOAP did, you know. At the beginning, SOAP was a simple object access protocol. And now they say it's just SOAP. There's no meaning anymore, you know? Job Runner, Job Runner. There's no more meaning. So it's interesting. So how you persist the state?
So what we do first, I already explained about analyzing the Lambda to get the details. So what we try to collect is the service typically that you're calling with the method, and then the arguments we all serialize as JSON. Mm-hmm. Why is JSON? Because I like simplicity.
Yeah, I'm glad it's not the YAML, but
indeed. It would have been a little bit shorter, but it would be so difficult to analyze if something goes wrong because we forgot to add a space somewhere.
Yeah, this is where I was sweating with the Kubernetes because everyone told me YAML is simple. And I never managed to write it. It's like, why it doesn't work? And because here is the space left. And so, and everyone told me it is that simple. It's like, I created a lot of XML. I never had a problem. And this now is YAML. I was sweating, you know?
Yeah, completely correct. Completely correct. So once we have the details with all the parameters serialized as JSON, we store it in the database, in fact. Mm-hmm. And typically it has an initial state, which is either enqueued, you want to run it as soon as possible, or scheduled, or the new state that we now have for carbon-aware job processing, it's awaiting the best moment. And then based when it's time to run the job, we start it, we load it from the database. If all goes well, it goes to succeeded state. Otherwise, it fails, and then it automatically starts retrying and retrying up until 10 times. With an exponential backoff policy. And if it then doesn't succeed, it goes to the failed state, definitely, where you can have a look and then see what went wrong exactly.
And where are you storing the JSON by default? Does it have to be the relational database or?
We support both. We serve all relational databases and MongoDB.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Yeah. So we used to also have Redis, but I really like Redis as a key value store, but I felt like we were abusing it for something it was not meant to support.
Why not S3?
I don't know enough about S3, to be honest. That's the reason.
You have to do that. And I explain you why.
Okay.
So S3 is the invention for AWS. It's more a rock-solid service on AWS, but it doesn't actually matter. The Java API is super simple. It's more or less a map, a hash map.
Okay.
It ships with additional support, like you get Iceberg for free and SQL support, which I wouldn't use in your case. But now it comes. Because S3 was so popular on AWS, it became standard. So you can run S3 on OpenShift API. And for instance, Min.io, they ship with S3 protocol. So all companies I know which run on-premise are using S3 as the API, and they use the AWS SDK to access their blob storage. Or Oracle Cloud, they have also persistent storage, also S3 compatible. So it means, for me, S3 is a standard like JDBC.
Ah, cool. And is it easy to search on certain properties, for example?
Not easy at all. So you cannot have full scan. You will have to implement it by yourself.
Yeah.
But all the cloud-aware databases are storing the state in S3. So it means you will have to do something about that. But it is the cheapest storage you can get.
Yeah.
So I'm pretty sure if you're running in the cloud on S3, and you have, I don't know, let's say 1,000 jobs, and they will access the S3 bucket a million times, maybe you will pay €3 or something.
Yeah.
There will be nothing to do for you. And what we did in Java projects, we actually use S3 to save money because it is a very reliable, it's transactional and cheap. You can have a huge object. So what you could do is you can store it in one bucket, everything, you know? Job definition and just read it and store it as JSON, for instance.
Yeah.
But I think you have to do this. So S3, you have to do this. So, I mean, Mongo is just too specific. It is. And if you have Mongo, what you can do for free is migrate to DynamoDB.
Yeah.
Because they are very similar. And DynamoDB on AWS is almost free. And if you have DynamoDB, you can migrate for free to Cassandra because Cassandra is very similar to DynamoDB.
Okay, because I once tried supporting Cassandra, but it's a long time. It was one of the second or third databases I tried to implement. But I found it, because we do quite some querying also sometimes.
This is the problem. The queries have to be simpler, or you have to even partially implement the queries by yourself. This is the price. Yeah. But what you get is reduced costs.
Yeah.
And so what I do, we move from on-premise to cloud. I already indicated that. And in some companies, we migrated from Postgres and Kubernetes to Lambda and S3.
Mm-hmm.
And in the most extreme case, I know, is they had maybe 50 tables.
Mm-hmm.
And now they have one bucket because they knew how the relations between the tables are, you know, and before they do one-to-one or whatever, they put everything in the Java domain object were similar to back then. They were just simplified and they stored it as JSON.
Oh, cool.
And it works. So you have to know what you are doing, but if you know your business, you can absolutely do this. But this is not as convenient, of course. It's not like it's cool to work with, but it's cheap.
Yeah.
Which for you is, I think, important.
Yeah. Yeah. We have had some requests about supporting DynamoDB, but that was before it supported Mongo completely.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something still on our to-do list. But indeed, perhaps S3, because a lot of our people are using JobRunner on AWS. And
Then you have to do S3, because for the MongoDB is way too expensive.
Yeah, okay. This is like
hundreds of euros, if not thousands, difference per month.
Yeah.
And S3, there is nothing to monitor, and it's better for the carbon neutrality, you know?
Because it's cheaper than a database.
So for me, my architecture right now, enterprise architectures, is we start with S3. If it doesn't work, DynamoDB.
Yeah.
But as simple Java code as possible. People ask me, when we have to migrate from AWS to Azure? Then I tell them, then we migrate the Java code and we'll pick the Azure service. You know, we rewrite a little bit the adapter layer and we are done. Because there is a blob storage. I mean, this is not like we spend, weeks just fiddling with the API. But if you try to abstract from everything, I think you will fight the abstractions. We had already, you know, the experiences from Java past. So I think write simple code to the point. And if you have to migrate, then you just sit down, migrate, and do it, right?
And it's like such a hypothetical question. I have not seen any company move from a database. So it's always, let's do onion architecture, because then we can swap out our database to something else or something.
The opposite is true. The databases, all cases I know, the databases outlived the applications.
Yes.
So the database lived longer in the companies than the applications. And they were still, you know, they were still afraid, you know, to be too depending on the database. They had DAOs and VOs and multiple layers. And I say, okay, you know, focus on business and don't write, you know, your data access layer.
Yeah, I am happy that somebody is preaching the truth out there.
And I'm also happy that I'm not crazy. So I will invite you over and over again as a therapy session, you know, once a week. We have so like, you know, it's okay, what was strange in your project? So you can tell me, I can tell you. So this would be actually cool. And there's another database interesting for you. It's called SkylaDB. Skylar, S-C-Y-L-A. And this is like they claim to be a DynamoDB competitor. But this is also good for DynamoDB. Because if I would like to use DynamoDB on AWS, the people ask me, you know, hey, and I don't know if AWS raises the prices, which never happened in the past, but they could maybe one day.
Yeah.
And if they could, I mean, then everyone they will outcry. So it will be not very wise from them. I don't believe it can happen, but it's the same likelihood that someone will swap DB2, replace DB2 with Oracle, let's say, right?
Yeah.
So, and then I tell them, okay, then we can pick SkylaDB and just, you know, migrated to EC2 machine on the data center, then everyone is happy. So this is why I know that. This is SkylaDB. Mm-hmm.
Are you still seeing the same approach that companies are still moving to the cloud? Because I hear a lot of them are now reverting it also.
Yeah. What I see a lot is there was a... So what happened... This was like before Corona time, pandemic, and during the pandemic. So people said, okay, Java is not cloud native or whatever. And then it became cloud native. And Google released Kubernetes.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was like, I don't know why, but all Java developers believed that Kubernetes is cloud native. So what they did is they migrated from local open. So everyone was, I know companies, they ran OpenShift or Rancher, and everyone was basically happy. But management decided to go to the cloud, and no one knows why. They said, okay, we need a cloud now. And what they did is, they migrate one to one from OpenShift to a Kubernetes distribution in the cloud, and this became extremely expensive. Of course, And then they say, okay, now we are cloud native, and I never got this because this lift and shift is just pointless. Because if you would like to go to the cloud, you have to improve your situation. Yeah, it should be carbon neutral or more energy efficient or something. But if you run the same stuff what you run on premise in the cloud, I mean, it cannot be cheaper. Well, yeah, exactly. It cannot be, right? So, and these companies, and in the beginning, they had free credits. So I was in companies, really, and I tried to know what I do in my workshops or even talks, cost-driven architecture. So we spent 3 days with an Excel sheet and say, okay, this is cheap and this is expensive. And back then, they told me, we don't care. This is cheap. Go away, right? So it works. But then they are now out of the credits. And now they are back, so, hey, this is way too expensive. Now we have saved money. And now what to do? And they saw the Daniel Hanemeyer Hansen from Ruby on Rails, who is really skilled, and he loves hardware, So for him, it's just joy to run his own stacks on-premise, which is not true for my clients, right? And now they don't know what they are doing and what they should do. And they are now confused, right?
Yeah.
And what I did is, if we had, I don't know whether you know about my past, but I really like Java-E, MicroProfile, Jakarta-E, Quarkus, this is my world. And likely what happened is the old Java-E applications, their code is highly compatible with Quarkus.
Yeah.
So there is nothing to do. And Quarkus turned out to be the fastest runtime. I think the fastest runtime on Java, which is great for money and CO2. And we could migrate the old code to Quarkus, and now it comes. You can run Quarkus as AWS Lambda.
Yeah.
And now it becomes interesting because you can migrate an old monolith to Lambda and you don't have to operate anything in the cloud. And with S3, I was at, you know, the JAX conference in Germany?
Yeah.
So 5 years ago, I told this at a conference, and 4 years ago, someone stood up. It's like, we did it. And I was a little bit afraid. I was like, okay, what's the results, right? They said, the entire application from back then, now we run for 80 euros a month. And this was a huge application, actually, because 80 euros traffic for Lambda is actually a lot. Because if you have two transactions per second, it will cost you $10. So it means they have at least 16, 20 transactions per second, day and night, right?
Yeah.
And this is what I am doing. So, and this is a hit, I would say. I get more project that I actually do, and this is where I spend my time. But I reject Kubernetes. So recently someone asked me about Kubernetes. I don't get it, because if you run Kubernetes in the cloud, you have two clouds, right? So you have your AWS infrastructure, which is ready to use, but say, no, I don't use this. I install on this existing infrastructure another infrastructure, and on this infrastructure, my application. And this is even worse than WebSphere application server in 1996, right?
So. I completely agree. For me, Kubernetes is perhaps good for 0.1% of the companies out there.
Perfect. Yeah, we have to schedule the next meeting as a therapy someone, you know, so...
We could make things so complex, but why? Is it job protection? I don't know. I saw a project recently where there were more microservices than team members.
Yeah, this is one of my jokes. This is not even a joke. This was a Java user group meeting. There were two Java developers and there were 100 microservices.
Then I asked myself, why?
Yeah, this is why. And this is actually good, because if you write reasonable Java code, you are unbeatable. That's the interesting part. And what I also do on AWS is CDK. This is like infrastructure as code with Java. And then the cool part is we have Maven in CDK and we have Maven in Java. And there's like the perfect storm, because you can be very efficient. But this is a different story. But interesting that you see this as well. So for me, if you say Lambda doesn't work on AWS, I will pick, for instance, ECS Fargate. This would be the easiest choice, right? And if this doesn't work, I think now is even time to think about, what about, you know, buying EC2 machine with a load balancer and put a minimalistic operating system which is supported by AWS and just, you know, put a Graal image or Quarkus one jar there and run it. Because this could be actually the solution for costs. Because if you have high load, this is unbeatable cheap. And you can buy the machine in 3 years in advance and save a lot of money.
The thing, because we are always, like, uptime is important and stuff like that. But I have something running at my home using simple Docker Compose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's 99.99% uptime. The only thing, when it goes down, it's because the streets, the electricity of my houses, they turn off the electricity because there are road levels. But for the rest, we tend to overcomplexify so many things, often for internal business application, that nobody is using at night.
And then the people complain Java is too complicated. Why are you not doing Python? Because in Python, they just implement something what they need, and then don't think, you know, about running Kubernetes for Hello World, right?
Yes, indeed. We make it too complex sometimes.
Yeah. But so what we learned is that you are extracting from Lambda, from the closure, from the environment of the Lambda, from the captured state of the Lambda, you're extracting the states, creating a JSON, and then you're storing JSON MongoDB right now, but you could use S3 or DynamoDB.
Yeah.
And maybe even save more costs, but now I get this, because it means... Where it runs in the cloud, or where the jobs are usually running, are these usually Docker containers?
We don't care. It's
usually, what is it? What do you know?
It's most of it's Docker containers, often still inside Kubernetes, I'm afraid.
No problems, man. You must not care. But on Kubernetes would be a huge waste if you think about this, because if the Docker container runs all the time, you know, your CO2 calculation doesn't matter then, because whether your job runs or not, the CPU still spins, right? So this is unfortunate.
Yeah, it still spins, but if you have an application that is idle, it spins at the bottom.
Yeah.
Whereas there is still a difference. But what we're now also looking at is scale to 1 and even scale to 0.
What I thought is, if you manage to go to S3, you can run the jobs as Lambda if they are shorter and you have 15 minutes time to complete. And then you can scale to 0 with extreme availability.
Yeah.
And you don't have to do anything. So this is actually, you look at that?
Yeah, I didn't look into it yet, but I'll take it with me because we currently, for all the recurring jobs, JobRunner still needs a masternode, which mm-hmm. checks what are the jobs that need to happen in the coming minute. In fact, every minute there is like a heartbeat. But we could also do that in an AWS Lambda externally, that it's like triggered automatically. And then you would only have a one-time setup. And then afterwards, all the management is done by JobRunner itself. So all the recurring jobs.
You get everything for free because if you migrate to AWS and you have some clients on AWS, you can use EventBridge Scheduler.
Yeah.
And EventBridge Scheduler is like a distributed, not JobRunner pinger, right? So it can do something, but it will just, you know, ping your Lambda, for instance. And just directly, Lambda wakes up, goes to S3. S3 is transactional. And tells other Lambdas to do the job or not.
Yeah.
And hey, the cool story is the event bridge, the messages in event bridge are JSON objects.
Oh, okay.
So, and this is 1 million messages, €1, as far as I know. So what you could do is you can coordinate everything with event bridge. Event bridge is pretty cool. It's a serverless. You don't have to set up anything. It is cheap. And you can have in event bridge multiple topics, which are buses is the name.
Yeah.
Topics, buses, with business names. And you can monitor them, log them. So you could have a serverless edition of your JobRunner. And if you're interested in a little bit, you know, infrastructure as code, if you go to my GitHub repository, there's one example on the top. It's like Quarkus CDK something. And this is Quarkus. I think if you have the credentials, in 5 minutes, you have the Lambda running with pure Java, no external dependencies.
Okay, cool.
And I have one workshop attendee. He's a lawyer. And he I think he's over 70 or 75, and he decided to have a startup business right now. And I had a podcast with him as well, and he took the example and managed to run it. So this is super simple. So this is really, really simple.
But I'm taking notes here also, because there is definitely things that you say that are really valuable. The only thing is, we are only a 5-man company. And we have 20 outstanding feature requests from customers. So it's so hard to balance the where I'm not only a developer now, I'm also now a product owner. And this is also, it's difficult to sometimes decide where we put time in, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, for me, it's the same, right? Because for me, I need a small examples, whatever, because if I get requests from my clients, I didn't like to start with zero. So usually the examples you see I use in projects. So I also have to focus time, but I think this is, you can save a lot of money for your clients. So this would be a huge business advantage. And you have already this Java knowledge. And with that, it's very simple to do, really. So it's fun. I would say just to try it out, maybe weekend projects. And for you or for the listeners, the Lawrence Patterson, and this was the episode number 147, and he's the lawyer. So it was after you, it was the episode with him, and he attended the AHEX because he was really into serverless and.
Cool.
And JurisTech, it was his company, or still is, I think. Yeah.
And what does he do exactly?
He created with Quarkus and serverless and applications to manage the, law agencies, you know, law offices. He had a specific, I forgot exactly, but he had specific problems to solve, and he was then happy, and now he doesn't attend my workshops anymore because it works. Basically,
he learned a lot.
But he was a really nice guy, so we had always chat, you know, because he is from Utah so pretty cool. So it means if we reduce the JobRunner to technology, it is basically a bytecode analyzer, and the bytecode analyzer looks at your code to find the state. It serializes the state with an adapter. It puts this to JSON. And then you have a trigger, which says, okay, take a look whether there's something to do, right? So you need a periodic ping because something has to wake up and do something, right?
Indeed. So by default, every 15 seconds, we check, hey, is there any work to do?
And who checks that? Because this is your single point of failure, right?
No, because it's distributed. You can have one or more. So each background job server can potentially be a masternode also. So the background job server that is running for the longest time, That's the master node. And what he does is he does a little bit more. He checks whether there are any jobs that are orphaned. If, for example, a Docker container was killed or a pod was killed or crashed. So he checks then and reschedules the failed jobs. And that one is also responsible for the recurring jobs. But for the rest, all the other nodes, they check, hey, is there any work to do? And if so, they just consume the work and process it as fast as possible. And as long as there is work to do, it will not wait for the 15-second ping. It will continue grabbing new work until everything is done.
How you call them, scheduler?
The master node, or what do you mean?
Master node, yeah. How you call them?
It's the background job server.
Background job server, okay. Yeah, so what's the architecture of job runner? So which components do you have?
In the background job server, well,
in total. Let's say I would like to, you know, I just pick your product and would like, you know, to send emails once a day. So what do I have to install? What do I have to do?
You add one jar to your project, and you're done.
Yeah,
and
then use the API. Yeah, but I still have to set up the persistence, whatever, right?
Yeah, with Quarkus, for example, and we automatically look, hey, is there any data source with which we are compatible? So we have a Quarkus extension, and then if it's compatible, then JobRunner will automatically install the tables for you. The moment that's done, you're all set to go. And then using one property, which can of course be a Docker environment variable, you enable or disable the background job server. Mm-hmm. And by enabling it, automatically any job that you are in queuing will start processing. And by default, it's disabled, this background job server, because let's say that you have your application serving your front-end and also your back-end. Well, you don't want any of your front-end nodes automatically starting to process jobs. But if you enable it on your one of your server, the property, then it will start consuming all of it. So one jar and two properties that you need to enable, I think. The other one is the dashboard. So the background job server, true or false, and dashboard, true or false. And that's
it. That's cool. It's a great developer experience, actually. So this is how it should be.
I like simple things, and I want to get people up and running within 5 minutes. Just like you.
But the job running in the background, it means it will automatically run on the same JVM where you started the job, right? So this is the idea.
It doesn't have to be. You can have... Let's say you have a web shop with two different front-end part and a back-end part, but it's the same application. You just, and what happens is you save the job, you enqueue the job, it gets serialized to the database, and then the other node can query, is there any work to do? And if there is, it processes it.
So, but they have to have exactly the same ClassWatch version, right?
Yes, indeed. So you have to have the same jar, in fact, the same compiled version of your jar, or the same Docker container should be backwards compatible. So
yeah, it's like agents back then. Yeah, aware of agents 20 years ago. Egglets and agent frameworks, this was like moving code, is the same. So there was a specific class loader which downloaded the stuff and executed this back then.
Yeah,
pretty cool. So so it means how you coordinate the masters? Is it like Paxos or what you did? You know,
No. I don't want any other dependencies. So what happens is the master nodes always do like a small heartbeat to the one of the tables, and it says every 15 seconds, hey, I'm alive, I'm alive, I'm alive. And then if this doesn't happen for 1 minute, then we know it's down, and another one automatically starts to take over.
So for my understanding, so it means if you go completely scale to zero, for you it would be almost nothing to do, because what you will get is, let's say we go to AWS. So you pick EventBridge scheduler, which is highly available, and they will just ping the table directly and see whether there's something to do.
Yeah.
If there is something to do, it will just call, you know, any Lambda, because you can have more than 1,000 Lambdas per account without anything. We just pick the next one and say, go. If this breaks, the state of the table didn't change. So he just doesn't care. He just go to the same table and say, okay, do it again. So then you have scale to zero for free, and you will have no masters, actually, right?
Yeah, indeed. I think it's definitely a possibility. Yeah.
Because your problem right now is, because if you're running on premise or on private OpenShift, let's say, there is nothing which is, how to call it, highly available in a central place.
Yeah, that's the problem.
This is why you distribute it and say, okay, I don't like to have single point of failure, because then you have to care about that. But in the cloud, you have services outside your applications which are highly available. And if you use them, you don't have the problem, right?
Yeah, indeed. You can move the responsibility to the cloud in that case.
This is great, because this will simplify a lot and will also reduce the cost.
Yeah, that's
actually a cool story. And back to ASM. So you are in the lucky situation that ASM becomes standard in Java, right?
Yes, indeed. So that's what we are looking now, that we don't, depending on which JVM version you're on, we will automatically switch to the Java 25 version. Cool stuff is happening.
And the last, but this idea is crazy, but just for the future. So there is a GraalVM. And GraalVM is able to compile Java code to WASM.
So what you could do is,
for lightweight jobs, you can say, okay, this jobs has specific requirements, because you cannot support everything. So you could cross-compile this job to WASM and run on Cloudflare or whatever, you know, on the edge of the thing as a Java code. So this would be, like, interesting take.
Yeah, indeed. But you already played with WASM?
Only because I sometimes had to, is if you have the edge functions, you know, to modify, let's say, headers, HTTP headers, so you have to write WASM, and you never write WASM directly. You use Java, C#, or Rust, or whatever, and then you get the WASM. But WASM 2.0 is out and comes with good Java support.
Okay, cool.
So it could be interesting for you. Maybe last question. So you mentioned JobRunner Pro and JobRunner Open Source. What's the difference? So what's, you know, when?
So in the open source version, you get, I think, we have more once been told it's feature complete for me, the open source version. So apparently you get a lot. There is the dashboard. There is everything we talked about. The pro version adds like workflows, batches. If you have a customer who has like multi-tenant setup, and one of the tenants creates 1 million jobs, yeah, typically it's first in, first processed. But in that case, we can guarantee that all the different tenants get, that all the jobs are processed. Well, it's more features mostly.
What would be also interesting, right? In the pro version, include the infrastructure as code, the entire setup for the cloud, which is not available. For instance, you could be play with it, but I'm absolutely for paying for software, because if you just pick, you know, the open source, you will have to invest your time to understand JobRunner.
Yeah.
So even if I had to do something serious, I will hire you. Why not? Or buy your stuff. Because sometimes, you know, asking you a single question can save days. So this is my experience.
Indeed.
So it is always good. Actually, a good strategy to save money is to, you know, to buy support from good software, especially from smaller companies. If you become big, you know, if next time, it would be even harder to schedule a job with you, because you have that, then, you know, multiple departments.
Sorry about that, by the way.
this was fun. It's not true at all. It was super easy. I have to say something, right? But in a few years, if your company grows, then sometimes support is bad, you know, because there's a support department and they have no idea what the developers are doing. But as long as the company is small, you have basically buy it, right?
What I insist is that every developer here, even I, I'm still doing support.
Yeah.
Because that way you learn and you feel the pain that the customers are having.
And new requirements, new use cases. If they ask you questions, you know, they say, okay, this is actually a good point. So this is also, this is why I like questions. So if I'm speaking at conference, this is like, you know, my support. It's like, ask me as many questions as you like. Is my idea crazy or whatever? That's Kubernetes and YAML or whatever. And last time I asked on a cloud conference, you know, what are your opinion? There was a table about Kubernetes, and everyone said the same what you said. It's okay, then I'm not crazy. Great, because otherwise I work in my own cubicle, you know, and whatever I say is true. But you can validate your ideas, and support is the same. You know, you can validate the use case. You can ask them, what about doing this? And they say yes or no, right? So this is,
Well, now we're even looking for our pro customers. Just like you mentioned, we have carbon-aware job processing, and we are now looking at cost-aware processing.
Mm-hmm.
And it would use exactly the same syntax, and it would use able you as the spot instances to even further reduce prices if you're running like on Fargate.
Yeah. And spot instances is the next step with EC2 machines. So you can get 80% off, but you have 5 minutes to move off. But for you, it's great because you have the 5 minutes.
Yeah.
So, this is actually, I would say serverless, if you cover serverless and spots, I think this is the best you can do because you have the opposite scenarios, you know?
Yeah.
The serverless is very good for low volume. This is almost free. And the spot instances are very good for really high volume because you get a beast of machine for free, basically. And with your infrastructure, you can absolutely do this. So this would be the two great strategies from my point of view.
Yeah. Well, I've noted them all down, so.
Cool. So we should reschedule not in 5 years, maybe earlier. I will ping you because it was a really nice conversation. And we can have, for instance, a chat next time about just, you know, how to develop features or how we see the code just for fun. And thank you.
I love
where people can buy your support. What is the website? Where I can find you?
Jobrunner.io. There everything Jobrunner.io. Is. Yeah.
Are you on DevOps this year?
I'm afraid not. My Carbon Aware talk was refused. But
you have to talk with Stefan.
So mention it to him.
Okay.
But I'll be JFall. I don't know. JFall, will you be there?
No JFall this time. I forgot actually. I have on my website 11 conferences. Dev Talks next week is in Romania. So this is one interesting one. I was 7 years ago, I think, there. Really nice. And Jax, WJAX, AuraDev. So as I remember. And Okay. Thank you a lot. It was a blast. And early next year, just do the next thing, because I'm curious about your serverless investigations and whether you like my core. So your homework is to try my Quarkus template, CDK, 15 minutes.
All right.
And if it doesn't work, ping me. And then we can talk about what's your findings on Lambda, because I'm really curious about that.
All right. Excellent.
Thank you a lot.
Same here. It was really fun chatting, and I'm happy that we both find, we're both not working in our own cubicle.
Yeah, very good. Thank you. Bye.
Bye.